From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The celebrated Russian emigre writer Vladimir Nabokov, author of Lolita, Speak, Memory, and much more, could be remote, condescending, arrogant. But if you caught him running through the Rockies in shorts with a butterfly net in the 1940s, you might not have known that. This hour On Point, how 20 years in America shaped the work of Vladimir Nabokov. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on, at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the sound of the master himself, 1950 CBC TV program Close-Up, Vladimir Nabokov describing the landscape of his classic novel, Lolita.
I have invented in America, my America, and just as fantastic as any inventor's America.
An invented America, but he spent 20 years deep in it in ways you might not imagine. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Robert Roper, author of a big new book, Nabokov in America on the Road to Lolita. Robert Roper, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What a great subject to pick up again and to do it through this lens. Can you understand this author by his American years without all that growing up on the great family estate in Russia, the flight from the Bolsheviks, the flight from the Nazis? How much of what we need to know and understand about this writer can we know from his time in America?
Well, that's kind of a trick question, Tom, because part of his work written in America includes Speak Memory, his great autobiography, which tells us all about his Russian background. So I would say in the light of that, yes, we can. Just looking at his writings in America in those 20 years, we can really get a very deep sense of him.
Can we just settle on pronunciation for a moment here? I've got colleagues who say Nabokov. I grew up, everybody around me said Nabokov. You've got yet maybe another way. What's the Russian way?
Well, Nabokov is what I've been taught and reprimanded to
okay.
learn. Most Americans, a lot of English people, anybody who's listened to the Sting song say Nabokov, but it was Nabokov, and he wasn't much of a stickler. He liked to be his name to be pronounced correctly, but he didn't go crazy if it was mangled a bit.
Remind us when and why he came to America and what his standing was in the literary world when he arrived.
He came in 1940 on the last ship of the line out of France before the war shut down everything. And in fact, the ship that he and his wife and his little boy came over on was sunk by a mine when it returned to France. And before that, he had lived in Berlin for almost 20 years as an escapee from the Russian Revolution. He and his family ended up in Germany, and then they lived there in Germany. His father was assassinated, a political assassination. And then in 1937, he and his Jewish wife and little boy got out of Germany and went to France. But France did not remain safe for long, and they had to get out of France. And they got out of France just by the skin of their teeth.
His wife Vera, famously, his son Dmitry, who would soon be running around the Rocky Mountains in the United States. That origin in Russia, this was not just any Russian family. He grew up on an aristocratic estate there. People talk about him coming without great English, but he was raised in part by an English governess.
Yeah. He had his parents were Anglophile. They loved everything English, and they were extremely wealthy. And so he was partly raised by English governesses who read bedtime stories to Vladimir and his brothers and sisters in English. So he did have an early exposure to the language, and then when they were kicked out of Russia, he had to go to university. He and his brother ended up at Cambridge, so they had a Cambridge education, largely in English. So the idea that he kind of picked up English in 2 weeks just for the heck of it so he could start writing in English and sell books here is a bit of an exaggeration. Still, it's a remarkable transformation to write, to have begun a career, a very considerable career in one language and then switch to another is very, very rare.
Remind us of the writer he was, the reputation he had when he arrived in the U.S. in 1940 on the last boat, as you say, out of Europe.
Well, in America, he had little to no reputation. But in the Russian emigre community in Europe, the Russians who had left Russia at the time of the revolution and huddled in France or in Germany, he was definitely the rising young star. He had written some brilliant early novels, a lot of poetry, short stories, and he was quite well known and quite respected. He also had enemies who thought he was, for various reasons, who didn't get with his writing. But he was quite well known in that small emigre community. Then when he comes to America, like I say, he was almost unknown.
Where did he land in the U.S.? I mean, institutionally, where he was teaching, he was writing. Summers, he was traveling in the West. Give us a sense of the geography of this writer in America.
Yeah, well, he landed in New York. He had a relative who found him in a little apartment for a while. What got him and his family into America, what really saved their lives, was an invitation to teach summer school at distant Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. He knew where California was, but mm-hmm. not much more. So he arrived in 1940, and then he was due to teach in 1941. And his friends, his fellow Russian emigres in New York, said, well, get on the train, hurry across the country. You don't want to run into any of those crazy Americans, you know, with guns and crazy attitudes. It'll only take you 3 days to get across the country on the train. But no, that's not what he wanted. He got a nice woman who had a new Pontiac to drive him and his wife and his kid across. And they took almost 3 weeks getting across. And he collected butterflies frantically and joyously all across the country. He was hungry to experience the interior of America. He was very, very eager to do it. For him, it was a joyful proposition rather than a frightening one.
Those summers were absolutely central here. You've got a map in the book of all the places that he would summer with his butterfly net, a famous collector of butterflies, but to Telluride and Grand Canyon and Estes Park and Jackson, Wyoming and Yellowstone. I mean, the mountains were beloved by him.
Yeah. He had a particular thing for mountains. He loved mountain terrain. The blue butterflies are called, the family is called the blue butterflies, often pretty little butterflies, tend to thrive at higher altitudes. So he was particularly eager to get into high mountain realms. So his itinerary in America, I mean, he collected in many, many other places, but his itinerary always included these high, often granite mountain zones like the Sierra Nevada in California or the Tetons in Wyoming. I'm a rock climber of a very modest level of attainment. And when I would climb in the West, I was curious to discover that often Vladimir Nabokov had been there earlier. And in fact, he gravitated to these areas that are famous and very well known among climbers.
Taught at Stanford briefly there, taught at Wellesley College, taught at Cornell, traveled all over the West again and again and again, and of course always writing as he went. Though you say the basic structure of Lolita he brought with him from Europe.
Well, I would say the theme of Lolita he brought with him, the story idea, which is this kind of terrible idea of a pedophile who becomes obsessed with a little girl, and he arranges to marry the mother of the little girl. And then when the mother dies, he inherits her in a legal sense and also mm-hmm. in a sexual sense. In the late 30s, while living in France, he made a pass at this material, and he wrote a novella called The Enchanter, which has since been published. And it's remarkably like the Lolita we know in the terms of that basic situation. As a novella, it doesn't come alive. It's a failure. He never published it until he became famous in America. When he came to America, he still had that idea in his mind, and he inherited a context that made the story immensely richer.
That is the American landscape.
Yeah, the American landscape, but other elements of our country, of our literary culture, made that story very, very resonant. One particular one is that one of the first categories of books that were immense bestsellers in America in the 18th and 19th century were Indian captivity narratives, stories, novels, or purported memoirs of Americans, European immigrants, usually women, who were abducted by Indians and taken to live off in the wilderness. Those books always had a sexual subtext, and there was often a traveling.
Or,
yes, some, and. There was always a traveling through the wilderness, a disappearing into the vastness of America, just like what happens in Lolita.
Robert Roper, please stand by in Berkeley, California. The new book is Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita, the main theme from behind us from the 1962 film adaptation of that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Vladimir Nabokov in America, the great Russian writer's big years in the USA, in the Rockies, all over, and the big American imprint on the author of Lolita, Pale Fire, Speak Memory. My guest is Robert Roper. He is author of the new book, Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here he is reading a bit of Lolita to an audience in 1964. It's the poem the central character, Humbert, writes when Lolita in the book, for a time, disappears.
Wanted, wanted, Dolores Hayes. Her dream gray gaze never flinches. 90 pounds is all she weighs, with a height of 60 inches. My car is limping, Lolita Hayes. And the last long lap is the hardest, and I shall be dumped where the weed decays, and the rest is rust and stardust.
Dolores Hayes, the poem there is for, who, of course, the character Humbert calls Lolita. Here's a scene from the 1962 film adaptation. Humbert, played by James Mason, finds himself reunited with Lolita, played by Sue Lyon, after taking her away from summer camp. Despite his eager affection, she teases, acting dismissive toward him.
You know, I've missed you terribly.
I haven't missed you. In fact, I've been revoltingly unfaithful to you. But it doesn't matter a bit, because you've stopped caring anyway.
What makes you say I've stopped caring for you?
Well, you haven't even kissed me yet, have you?
Robert Roper writes about the years in which that book was put together. Can you explain, Robert Roper, there in Berkeley, California, how this became a bestseller? You know, these are the McCarthy years, and then written, I suppose, through the wartime. This is a conservative time in this country. What was the reception? How was it understood?
It was a treat to hear that poem and that clip from the film. How it became a bestseller? Well, Nabokov wrote it in the. He began in the late 40s, and it took him a few years, and he was quite aware that there were legal consequences for writing what was considered pornography at the time. His good friend, Edmund Wilson, had written Memoirs of Hecate County, a very interesting novel with some racy passages, some sexy passages, and it had been, after beginning as a bestseller, it had been prosecuted and banned with terrible consequences. Wilson's publisher lost a lot of money. He lost a lot of money. It was really something to be avoided. So Nabokov starts writing this book about a sensational sexual subject, and he's fully aware that he may never be able to publish it. And then when he finished it, he circulated the manuscript among most of the best publishing houses in America, and it was turned down everywhere. It was just much too dangerous. Nobody would take a chance on it. And however, an early first edition was published in 1955 in France in English by the Olympia Press, which was known for publishing works of pornography and other works too. But it was definitely a kind of a shady operation. So at least it existed in some form. But nobody in America could buy it unless they went to France. Somehow a copy got into the hands of Graham Greene, the well-known British novelist. Mm-hmm. And at the end of 1955, he said that one of the three best books he had read last year was a little-known novel called Lolita, and he praised it highly. And that brought it some attention in a lot of literary circles, and it became a little bit of a cause célèbre. So the wheels are turning of the whole movement against restrictions on literature at this exact same moment. Mm-hmm. There were litigations about Lady Chatterley's Lover, about Tropic of Cancer, and all of Western culture was slumberingly moving towards a different position about really you can publish works of great literary value if they have sexual themes. And Nabokov happened to write his book exactly at that moment as that process was ongoing. And finally, in 1958, a publisher, a good American publisher, decided they would take a chance. And it was legal changes had just enough of them had happened that it all worked out. And Nabokov's book came out. And it by 1958, everybody wanted to read it. They had heard it was a racy, terrifically funny and disturbing novel, and there was immense pent-up demand for the book. So it became a tremendous success as soon as it was published in America.
How did he describe what he was looking to convey, explore here?
Well, what's notable is that he didn't say that he was trying to write something that would expose the terrible tragedy of sexual abuse of children. He had no intention to reform society. He didn't believe in novels that attempted to reform. He found them boring. He said he was just writing a supreme work of art that, as we heard in the quote, one of the quotes you ran, mm-hmm. he invented his own America. And if you want to take my book on its own terms, read it, but don't expect to find a message in it mm-hmm. or any kind of a reforming impulse. That was his line. I mean, I think he was authentic in what he said, although we have to parse what he tells us about his motives and what the book does. I think the book is very, very powerful as an exploration of sexual predation. It's very, very disturbing. A lot of readers, it's still disturbing. And in fact, in a way, it began the opening to discussion of this subject that had formerly been very, very much hidden, very much.
Here's Nabokov in his own words. This was on the CBC program Close Up in the 1950s, saying critics of his book didn't understand its meaning.
That's because they think in clichés. For them, sex is something so well-defined that there's a kind of gap between it and love. They don't know what love is, perhaps, and perhaps they don't know what sex is either.
Listeners on all sides of this, Hello Kitty writes, there's nothing like reading Nabokov. The way he plays with words is inspired. Reading his work, like going to the gym for my brain. I enjoy every moment of it. Lolita, absolutely one of my favorite books. Not everybody's in that camp. David in Providence, Rhode Island. David, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am glad we reached this point because I disagree with your guest in some ways. I think in many ways, Lolita, as great as it is an immoral book, because I think personally that Nabokov kind of fell in love with Humbert and turned him into a hero rather than a monster. It's against the pathology of pedophiles. Pedophiles, as Andrew Vox has pointed out in his criticism of the novel, says that pedophiles do not have empathy. They do not regret anything except being caught. The idea that Humbert is actually in love with Lolita is grotesque. Lionel Trilling said it's a book about love. It's not about love. It is about rape. It's a brilliant book, and it is disturbing, but it disturbs me about Nabokov, too, because certain aspects of Nabokov's character, particularly the butterfly collecting, which I consider a form of unpardonable sadism, well, they frankly disturb me. And I'd love to hear what your guest has to say, and I'll take the question off the air.
Thank you, David. Robert Roper, put the pen through the butterflies. Sadism, says David, and the same for Lolita, for that matter.
Well, you know, it's hard to disagree with your caller if that's the way he experiences the book. And I think there are a lot of readers who just are turned away by it. They just don't want a novel to be written about this. This is terrible. This is a terrible thing. We shouldn't turn our gaze upon it. Nabokov was a different character. He thought he could turn his gaze anywhere. Does he sensationalize pedophilia? Does he stretch the truth about it? Perhaps, but he certainly studied up about it an awful lot. He read a lot of case histories. He knew that most pedophiles are perhaps without empathy, and certainly they're monstrous in their behavior. But I think you have to submit yourself to the book. I'm not a believer in burning any kind of book, even the most terrible book. I think to make a judgment about it, you have to read it. You may be repulsed, and after 20 pages, this is just – but an awful lot of people, millions and millions of people have turned to it and read it and been deeply moved, not deeply moved by feelings of love for Humbert, but feelings of love and pity for the girl, who emerges as not just a little teeny bopper, bobby soxer kind of ideal of fascination for a pedophile, but as a real person who deepens and deepens and becomes increasingly fascinating to Humbert as well as to the reader. I think we finally have to use that test. Look at the book, start reading it.
Larry in New Orleans. Thank you for joining us, Larry. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am a student of this book. I have read it several times. And one thing I note that you haven't mentioned is the movie by Jeremy Irons plays in, and also the book on Lolita, read by Jeremy Irons, is a great listen. If you ever have a long trip in a car and you want to take a book along and play it on your CD player in your car, Lolita.
So is it sadistic porno, Larry, or is it a fascinating exploration of human nuance? Where do you come down?
I don't think it's sadistic at all. I think it is an experiment in language more than anything. Nabokov, he wrote a poem, almost a poetic part there, and when he takes Lolita to the Enchanted Hunter's Hotel for the first time, he writes about the mural on the wall of that Enchanted Hunter's Hotel, and he writes, if the management of the Enchanted Hunters had asked me to paint a mural on their wall of my choosing, here is what I might have painted. Let me list some fragments. There would have been a lake. There would have been an arbor, inflamed flower. There would have been nature studies, a tiger pursuing a bird of paradise. There would have been those luminous globules of Glanadel glow that travel up and down the opalescent sides of jukeboxes. And there would have been a sultan, his face expressing great agony, belied, as it were, by his molding caress, helping a Calipigian slave child to climb a column of hunts.
Wow. Larry, I appreciate the read. Robert Roper, he's got the jukebox lighting in there along with, you know, the classical references. And
yeah, that's a note I like very much, yeah. Yeah.
That's right, in the wheelhouse of the Nabokov that you're focused on, who brought Americana right into this European-born initial concept of Lolita.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's, you know, we heard that little section of him reading his poem about Lolita, and he sounds like a parody of a supercilious European-educated professor.
Yes, he does. Yes. And
he did sound that way, especially in public performances as a personal, you know, on a personal level. If you met him on the street, he didn't sound like that at all. But he was quite aware of sounding laughably like a parody of himself, and he often undercuts himself by sticking in just ordinary facts of ordinary life. And for example, in this wonderful selection that our caller has read about the jukeboxes, his book, which is high art. I'm sorry I have to say that, but it's also very, very funny and readable on the simplest level. Here, as an example, some years ago, I came home and I found my 11-year-old daughter curled up on the couch laughing, reading a paperback book that she had gotten down from my bookshelves. And I said, "What are you reading, sweetheart?" And she said, she looked at the cover and said, "Lolita."
Oh, boy.
And I said, "Wait a minute. Wait, I never said you could read that." Although I had said she could read any of my books. You know, I didn't. And she read it and I said, you know, "Do you understand what's going on?" She said, "Yeah, yeah." You know, anyway, she read the book. And I know a lot of other young readers, kind of adventurous young readers, often read the book. They don't understand the moral depth, the complexity, and I hope they don't understand the sexual things that are going on. But they do understand it, and they can enter the book. It is immensely captivating and simple to read on one level. And later on, my daughter and many, many other readers read it as adults, and they begin to see darker overtones and complexities. But it's a very, very, very approachable book.
Did he respect his American audience, that European who could sound so supercilious, as you say?
Did he respect his American audience?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he, in the sense that he wrote for an American audience. He studied the American audience and what was being written and what was popular in America. He studied it very closely, and he wrote to his sister, who weathered World War II in Europe. He wanted to bring her and her son over to America. And he said, you know, America is actually they say it's full of louts and vulgarity. And sure, that's true. But it's also full of terrific people, very cultured people who understand things on a soulful level. So he didn't feel that he was here with a bunch of rubes and he was a great artist and he was all alone. No.
Robert Roper's new book is Nabokov in America on the Road to Lolita. Little Lolita Yaya by Nelson Riddle here from the 1962 film adaptation of Lolita. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Vladimir Nabokov in America. Robert Roper is with us. He's just come out with a big new book, Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita, looking at the 20 years or so, 40 to 60, that the great writer spent in the United States. Born to an aristocratic Russian family, fled the Bolsheviks. In late 1930s, fled the Nazis out of Europe, one of the last ships out of France. Landed in America and made his name here in a huge way with Lolita, with Pale Fire. Worked on his famous memoir, Speak Memory, while he was in the United States. Robert Roper tells the story of the imprint there. Off and out with his butterfly net in the Rocky Mountains, loved the American West, incorporated much of everyday Americana into his novels. There's an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Roper joins us from Berkeley, California. And we've got listeners who know something of Nabokov. Julian in Falmouth, Massachusetts. Julian, thanks for calling. What do you know?
Well, thanks. I enjoy your program. Well, I know Nabokov because I took his course. I was at Cornell in the early 50s. And in 1952, his course was called The European Novel. What did the students call it? They called it Dirty Lit.
Why? What?
They called it Dirty Lit because among the novels we studied were Emma Bovary and Anna Karenina.
Mm-hmm.
This was the character of what was called Dirty Lit at that time. And Nabokov was intensely interested in the craft of writing. And there were memorable lectures that I remember now, so many years later. More than 40 years later, I still remember some.
Convey a moment. What was he like in the hall, the lecture hall?
Oh, he was wonderful. The lecture hall was full, and standing at the back in Goldwin Smith Hall, which would hold several hundred students, there were students lined up, standing, who were not taking the course. They were there to listen to his lecture. He was just such a marvelous teacher.
Was he the supercilious European handing wisdom down to the Americans? What was his attitude, or what was the charm?
No, not at all. He was charming, and he was full of fun. Mm-hmm. He would, for instance, say he'd look over the audience and put his glasses down over his nose, and he would say, "Ladies and gentlemen, how many of you are now reading Emma Bovary in the original French? Don't be shy. Raise your hands. No one? Pity."
Oh, I love it. You put us right there. And what did you make then of Lolita in that context, Julian, having studied with him at college?
Well, you know, what I appreciated about him most of all was his insistence that the stories of most great novels is the story of boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. And one of his wonderful lectures was one in which he gives away the end of the novel, and everybody in the audience starts to boo. And he looks over his glasses and he says, what? Are you reading this for the story? How many of you are now reading it for the second time to appreciate the craft of the writing? And, of course, no one raises their hand. And he would say again, pity. And he'd talk about it. The whole lecture then was about the craft of writing. So Lolita, for me, is a book about human character, and it's written in a way that I need to be appreciative of the writing, of the craft of the writing. He would read a letter from Flaubert, from Gustave Flaubert, when he's writing Emma Bovary. And in the letter, he writes, "One day, one page." And Nabokov loved that he would toil over one page again and again and again to get it as perfectly as he could, and that people would skip over it and not appreciate what he had done.
Julian,
so his idea was, forget the story, reread the novel.
Though it's hard to forget the story. You know, you bring us a gift, putting us there in the lecture hall with him in 1952, and you've got the enthusiasm to prove that you were there, and I'm really grateful for that, Julian. Thank you for calling with that. Thank you. Yes, Robert.
Yeah, that was great. That's great to hear from Julian. Many people who were lucky enough to take his courses at Cornell in particular found them to be life-changing experiences. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is another as an undergraduate, she stumbled into his class and she said, "Nabokov taught me how to read." And she still reads with a great alertness and has immense fun reading good books. So, he was a captivating and deeply memorable teacher as well as a wonderful writer.
No mean accomplishment to teach a future Supreme Court justice how to read. That's important. Nina, yeah. In East Hoosick, New York. Nina, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks so much. I enjoy your show. I read Lolita first when I was about the age of the biographer's daughter. And my response was not humorous, but rather I recognized in myself, I came from a liberal and cultured family, that so we were able to talk about it. What I didn't talk about was the fact that this was a compelling story about the attraction from the young girl's side toward the older man. I think that Nabokov dared to talk about it. He didn't condemn Humbert Humbert, and he didn't. He wasn't trying, I don't think, to write a moral book. And maybe that's part of his point.
How do you think about it now, Nina, from the perspective of a grown woman?
Here's the thing. Before I answer that, I would like to say something, that there is a tradition in European, I am not condemning at all of him. I am a tremendous admirer of Nabokov, but in Europe, for instance, Marguerite Duras' movie and book, The Lovers, is also about young girls and older men. This is a pretty taboo idea here in this country, but it is not foreign to European nor Russian mentality. And now I think of it, you know, it's a great work of art. I mean, he's one of the masters of the English language. I don't think it's possible to answer, you know, how, I don't think it's going down the right path to say, how does he justify not condemning this person? I don't think that's the point of the book. And that as a very young reader, I recognize something in myself about this attraction to older men of young girls. I'd like to hear what the your guest has to say on all this.
Nina, thank you so much. Robert?
Yeah, thanks, Nina. Very interesting observation. I have to disagree with you. I think he certainly does in their first encounters. I mean, Lolita is crazy, has a big crush over this handsome lodger who's come to live at her mother's house. Yes, and she's a bit advanced for a young girl, although Nabokov was careful to read studies of a sexual experience of American teenagers, so he knew he was not completely out of the ballpark. But he does condemn Humbert Humbert. He categorically condemns Humbert, or should we say Humbert, who is the narrator of the book, condemns himself. They had an attraction. There's a young girl of 12 who was sweet on a handsome older man. Yes, but that was the door that opened to years of sexual predation, and that most readers take away, and Humbert, the book is a tragedy. We need to remember that it's a tragedy played for laughs. That sounds incongruous and impossible, but it is very, very tragic. So I think it's, you know, got darker tones, and it does recall also recalls the Marquis de Sade and other works of European literature, but I think there is definitely a very thorough moral condemnation of the sexual predation of this child.
Daniel in North Carolina. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the show. Mm-hmm. If I sound a little bit breathless, you'll understand why. I was the victim of a child molester, and which is an emotional topic.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm calling in is because the man, I won't mention his name, but I will say he was beloved as an English teacher at a school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a beloved crew coach at Harvard, at Harvard University. The reason that he was able to attract so many children was because of his charisma and because of his personality. And when pedophiles are demonized and kind of cast as these satanic characters, I think whether they're priests or Boy Scout leaders or English teachers, whomever they may be, I think what's overlooked is that oftentimes they are very highly respected in the community. They're beloved by many people, which is what allows them both to attract the children and allows them to get away with the sexual predation.
Yeah, so don't look for an obvious monster there. And of course, that must be a pattern that's true. Daniel, I appreciate your call. I want to get to a little more Nabokov, but you remind us of the real consequences when this predation, as Robert calls it, comes into the world. Nabokov turned it into literature. It wasn't the only book that he wrote when he was in the U.S. Here's a little bit of a longer piece of tape. This is April 5th, 1954, reading from Pale Fire at the 92nd Street Y in New York.
I shall now read a passage from Pale Fire, describing the narrator's friendship with the poet Shade. For those who committed the grave mistake of not reading my novel, I should add that both my poet and my speaker are invented characters. Never shall I forget how elated I was upon learning that this suburban house rented for my use from Judge Gawsworth, who had gone on his sabbatical to England, into which I moved on February 5, 1959, stood next to that of the celebrated American poet whose verses I had tried to put into Zemblin two decades earlier.
Nabokov in 1954, reading there from Pale Fire. Robert Roper, remind us what happened with his standing, his reputation during those 20 years in America. He really soared.
Yeah, right. Well, he was pretty obscure, although he was a very busy writer and he achieved critical success on a small scale well before Lolita happened. He was very fortunate. His cousin, Nicholas Nabokov, who was a very interesting composer who had come to America a few years before Vladimir, introduced him to Edmund Wilson. Edmund Wilson was a great writer, the most influential literary journalist in America at the time, and he happened to be crazy about Russian literature. And so Wilson was very happy to meet this obscure Russian who had arrived on our shores, and he was very, very helpful introducing Nabokov to people at the New Yorker magazine, for example, and also at the New Republic and other places. And so Nabokov began publishing stories, poems in the New Yorker and other magazines. And then his book, Speak Memory, which was a collection of pieces, many pieces which had appeared earlier in the New Yorker, came out and was a success in a small circle. People, New Yorker readers liked it, and he was well known, and he had this budding career. But it could have ended up being a very, very small career, except that he was determined to write great novels, and he was also determined to write something that, in a strange way, was right over the American plate. He read, at least looked at, a lot of popular novels. He was very aware of what his contemporaries were writing. And one thing that they were writing in the 1940s, early 50s was sexy books. So he sort of I don't mean to say that his motives were common, ordinary commercial motives, but he was not immune to the idea of having a big commercial success.
You write that he arrived penniless, without a secure language to write in. He became the most famous literary writer in English in the world. His early Russian novels began to be republished after this American period in translations. Soon he was declared an immortal, a giant on the order of Proust, Joyce, Kafka, The struggling writers everywhere took note. That's a pretty big bump up from how he arrived.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why his story is very inspiring to young writers, wannabe writers. But the real reason he's inspiring is because of his writing. Especially writers just often fall in love with him. He can do things in prose that nobody else could do in the 20th century. But yeah, it was a tremendous transformation. And he wrote casually to his sister, this dear sister of his who remained in Europe. He said I believe it was 1958, after the publication of Lolita, he said, "I don't believe I'm going to have to teach anymore," which was quite an understatement. He became wealthy overnight. It had been a life of ordinary, normal struggle, a lot of financial struggle, which he did not complain about. He enjoyed. I think one of the things that America represented for him and his family was a chance to make it, a chance just to have ordinary lives, possibly healthy lives, with a chance at happiness.
He said in one interview, "I don't wish to touch hearts and I don't want to affect minds very much. What I want to produce is really that little sob in the spine of the artist reader." And then the 1960s come and he's off to Switzerland and another realm. But 20 years of America behind him where his way was made. Robert Roper writes it in wonderful clarity and detail in his book Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita. Robert Roper, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.